Good afternoon, good people, and welcome to the Poolproof Wisdom Podcast, Conversations. The COVID-19 pandemic changed everything we thought we knew in ways many never expected. As America and the world has begun trying to reestablish a normal after nothing was normal, one thing is true. The pandemic's effects will linger on long after the virus's immediate threat becomes but a memory. Nowhere is that truer than when it comes to how we work. The pandemic disrupted the job market, with millions losing jobs or furloughed. Working from home taxed patients and overall mental health for some when businesses closed in response to mandated shutdowns. Battles over who is considered an essential worker and what protections they deserved ensued. And now, roughly 16 months after all this began to define work as we know it, we're struggling with why we work, what we expect from work, where we work, and, in a growing number of instances, whether we want to work at all. The question I and millions of you have is, what does it all mean? Well, I don't have the answer, but fortunately have friends who have some keen insights that will help us make sense of what we're witnessing and experiencing as people and companies adapt to new behaviors, define a new normal, and reestablish what it means to work now in a world after COVID-19. My friend, Angie Lindsay, has dedicated the last 20 years of her career to helping companies build great teams through exceptional recruitment strategies, as well as helping individuals achieve their career goals. She leads Lindsay Careers, a national executive search firm that specializes in marketing and communications recruitment and career coaching. She has successfully filled communications leadership roles for companies including Logitech, Serta Simmons Bedding, Nordstrom, Jackson Family Wines, A.T. Kearney, Omnitrax, Travelport, Cosmos Energy, Dolby, Kimberly-Clark, and dozens upon dozens more. Angie has been a featured presenter and keynote speaker at international and regional industry conferences, as well as at academic institutions from Columbia University to the University of Washington. She also authored the book Dare to Be Deliberate, Level Up Your Communications Career, a guide for communications professionals who want to be more intentional in how they manage their careers. A 3-time Public Relations Society of America Silver Anvil Award-winning communications pro herself, Angie understands the sector and what it takes to succeed in it. She's held communications roles in corporate and agency environments, as well as served for 25 years in the military, first as a U.S. Army journalist and then as a Navy Reserve public affairs officer. She graduated from the highly regarded School of Journalism at the University of Missouri and later earned a master's degree in career development. But don't think that her expertise and insights don't apply to other industries beyond communications and other work trends, because they do. They really do. So, listen and learn, good people. Because if you're trying to figure out what's next in your career, you're going to hear some things I know will resonate with you and help you realize that even now, you still have options. You just need to be smart about the choices you make. Good afternoon, Angie. I'm so glad you're here and welcome to the Poolproof Wisdom Podcast. How are you this afternoon?
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it wasn't that long ago that I was on your great podcast. Tell people a little bit about your podcast, by the way.
So my podcast is called Dare to Be Deliberate, and it all goes in line with the book that I wrote called Dare to Be Deliberate. And you know me, I'm all about being intentional in how you manage your career. Right. So my podcast is a combination of things. I either do a 5-minute short podcast that's just a tip that's around career development or job search or something like that. Or I do a full-on interview with people who I think are daring to be deliberate in how they manage their career.
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun, by the way, and you learn a great deal from the podcast. I can say, as a person who was the guest, I learned a lot just from the questions you asked. So thank you.
Oh. Well, thank you.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. But, you know, the reason I wanted to talk about this subject that I've come up with, and I've called it Working Now, A Whole New World. You know, as I've listened and viewed and just spoken with people about where we are now with career planning, with the job market, everyone is just, they have no clue. They're like, what is going on? And they don't know how to prepare for it. All the old rules are now off the table, and no one knows what the new rules are. So I thought, who do I know who, first of all, has a cool head about it, who has insights and experience based up on seeing changes in the marketplace when it comes to work before, but who also understands what people are feeling and thinking and how that influences what they're going to do next. And lo and behold, here's Angie Lindsay. So again, I'm very glad you're here today because I wanted to first get your thoughts about this place we find ourselves in when it comes to work. How would you define it?
Well, I think that, you know, the last year and a half-ish, it really caused a lot of people, I mean, everybody, right? We all had to shift. And some people loved the shift. Some people, and I don't think we loved the shift entirely, but some people loved the opportunity to be able to work from home and they thrived in that. And other people really did not thrive. And so, but I think the most important thing that happened, and we're all reading this in articles everywhere, is people started rethinking their priorities and their values and what matters to them. And are they being fulfilled at their job? And what's this going to look like? And I don't think anybody knows what it's really going to look like, but people are just at a time, I think, of personal reflection and trying to decide what does this mean for me and my future? And how am I going to take charge of that?
And with that comes this kind of, you know, discussion around, I've seen it more times than I can count now. And I know you've got opinions on it, so that's the reason I'm going to introduce it. This whole concept of the Great Resignation. Talk to me about that and how that plays into what you just described.
Well, you know, there's tons of articles out there that there's going to be this Great Resignation. Like, I think Bloomberg did a survey and somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of workers say that they're planning to change jobs or quit their jobs this year. That's a huge amount of people that want to make a move. Will that happen or not? I actually just posted an article on LinkedIn by Dori Clark, who talked about, you know, here's some things to think about before you quit, right? Because quitting may not actually be the answer to give you that career satisfaction that you're seeking. It might just mean a good conversation with your boss or, you know, working out a compromise if, you know, the hybrid work schedule isn't quite what you can handle right now or whatever the case may be. But I think people are willing to quit if they can't get the work-life balance thing figured out.
Right, right. What makes this challenging? And I read just because I like knowing what's going on. I actually end up, you know, hiring people every once in a while, and I like to know what I'm up against. But that feeling that people have that makes them conclude, you know, damn it, I'm just not even going to go back to work at all. I'm done with this. Isn't that a signal that something more is afoot than just their personal feelings? Is that not a signal to corporations, companies about cultures and work that they need to be paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'm an expert in this area, but I can say as an expert in the world of recruiting and career coaching that organizations are going to have to figure out how to keep their employees. And what I'm seeing with my client companies is they are so hungry to have everybody back in the office. They just want to get their culture back. It's really hard to retain corporate culture if you're all at home. And it takes some really good leadership, really strong leaders to be able to manage a remote workforce that and retain a culture, right? So that's really a big struggle for companies. And then I think for people too. I've been talking with, I just am working on a position right now and it's a marketing role. And almost everyone I'm talking to is so happy that it's a hybrid role where they're going to be in the office 3 days a week because they want that collaboration. They want to see their team members, especially if you're in a creative field. I don't think that's exclusive, but when you're in a creative field, it's that moment where you're just bouncing ideas off each other kind of serendipitously that some of the greatest ideas happen. And so people are hungry for that again and hungry to be next to people who are smarter than them, that they can learn from, because you get kind of stifled when you're just sort of in your little corner of your house.
And are there any indications that there are differences here along demographic, other related, you know, categories like age and whatnot? Or is that just a general consensus?
You know, again, I can't say that I'm an expert in this, and I certainly haven't done studies or research on it. I can just say I work with corporate people. I tend to work with a certain demographic, so I can tell you what I see in them. And I think it's universal. Some people were super equipped and ready to work remotely, and they understood the technology to do so. And other people really struggled with it. And it could just be because of your, you know, maybe you have young kids at home. Maybe you live out in the country and you don't really have great broadband. I mean, there could be a million different things that play into it.
So, you know, the thing that I think about, it's an interesting thing. The reason I ask that question is because I started a new job, literally moved here to Los Angeles in February of last year, got to work for 8 days. And then, of course, we had the shutdown. Now, it was not challenging as much for me because of the nature of my personality. You and I spoke about this before. I'm an introvert, despite people thinking otherwise. I'm also a person who is completely the king of the germaphobe. So being out of an environment where I was threatened by germs was, you know, conducive to my well-being. So as I look at this now, I have been effective in doing what I do. Number one, because in other roles, I've been a regional person where you live one place, you travel other places, so I was used to it. But I do find that as I am looking at the future now, I'm kind of sitting and wondering, what are we going to end up doing? Because personally, I kind of like working from home because I get to do it on my own hours. I have my own flexibility. I rise early, so on and so forth. And I was just wondering in general if you had any insights to that, because a lot of people I talk to, you're absolutely right. It's almost split down the middle where people are saying, I want to stay home, or I can't wait to get back to the office, particularly people with kids. They really want to get back to the office. So I think that as we're looking ahead, that that hybrid model probably seems like, for most organizations, and neither you nor I know, but for most organizations, it's probably the thing that is going to most make people happy. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean, I that's what I'm hearing from candidates and clients alike, is that, you know, imagine if you were driving an hour and a half each way to work every single day. And that's 750 hours of commute time a year. That's 3 weeks of vacation time if you weren't spending that time on the road, right? So when you think about it that way, the amount of work a person can do, the amount of stress on their life, the cost of commuting, I mean, the time and expense and stress, all that, to take at least part of that away and say, yeah, work from home 3 days a week or 2 days a week. That's awesome, right? That, I mean, like, that has got to benefit companies, in my opinion, that has to benefit companies. And if an organization is set up that that will work, I think more employees are embracing that model because we do need each other as well. We need those live connections as well. And I'm hearing about it happening in different ways. It might be 2 or 3 days a week you come into the office, or I heard of one company recently that's looking at doing 1 week a month, where everybody's in the office 1 week a month and the rest of the time they're working from home. Interesting.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you point it out that way, because the key word, if I were going to take one word that came out of 2020, COVID-19 related anything, it was adaptability. And that's whether you're the individual, the company, or society at large, because everything has been about getting used to the unexpected. And when it comes to the individual, however, I want to kind of move to this discussion, because more than anything, people had to learn how to work differently, no matter what, no matter what they were used to, no matter what they were comfortable with. Do you think we're going to find that people have learned, and this is all speculative, I know, but that they've learned that what's come out of this whole experience is that something they didn't think they were capable of, they actually were capable of, and that may drive them to look at ways to redevelop and retrain their own skill set going forward, because they found that there was something beneficial that they were able to get out of that experience? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that I would turn that around a little bit just because in my whole, you know, being intentional in how you manage your career, hopefully we always are doing that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the pandemic made people, it accelerated a lot of people's thinking about their career. It forced people to think differently about their career. It forced people to evaluate things they may never have thought they were going to evaluate. Mm-hmm. And so in my philosophy around being intentional, I think this is such a huge opportunity for people to say, okay, what did I learn from this? It wasn't all bad. Mm-hmm. What am I really good at? What do I want my work to look like in the future? What gaps are in my skill set that are going to prevent me from being able to do that so I can get trained in that? And where are my strengths in that? And then how do I tell that story so someone wants to hire me to do that? Or how do I tell that story to my boss so my next assignment in my current company is that thing that is my next stretch and growth assignment? One thing I am reading a lot is people are afraid that they're not growing because they were at home working. They didn't have training because companies were so focused on just trying to, you know, keep the wheels on. They weren't able to invest in learning and development of their employees. So hopefully people will be able to get back into the growth of their careers.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit more about that intentionality. This is just, I love this. This is awesome. So, you know, I think that a lot of people, and this, you know, is something that I sometimes think that I've been working in dog years. I know how long I've been working, but it seems like so much longer. But I think that a lot of folks get up and they go to a job and it's a job, right? And they do that job for a set number of hours per day. They go home and then somewhere in between, they fit in those things that are considered important to their lives. But intentionality dictates that you think of it differently, as you've described here. And when people are pressed to do that, do they find, or have, in your experience, I'll put it that way, I'm keeping up with you here, Angie. In your experience, do you find that people reveal that they were not being intentional, that they thought as intentional as they thought they might have been? Or are people really on point when it comes to what they're doing with their career?
Well, I think most of us are head down, busy managing our jobs, and we forget to look up and manage our careers, which I think it's a big difference there. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting. I am a person who believes that I have to love what I do.
Right.
I also believe that when you love what you do, it feels a lot less like work, right? You have a lot more fun. You spend a whole lot of time on a job, so you might as well like it. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to be in roles that align with your values, align with your priorities, align with those things you don't have to be super passionate about it. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, like some of the things I love to do in my personal life, thank God it's not my job. I might end up hating it, right? And so, but I also know there are people who want a job, who want to go make a living, leave the office or leave their work site and not have to think about it after they come home from work until the next morning.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that either. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's totally fine. People view their career, you know, is it a job or is it a career? And, you know, and what is it, a means to an end or is it the end itself? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But for me, I love to love what I do. Right. And so that's why the whole Dare to Be Deliberate concept came about, is because for others who want to be passionate about their careers, there are ways to think about it. Like, you just have to do little things daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and annually that just keep you on track.
Right.
So that you're not head down just managing your job. This is what I hear all the time from people when I'm either coaching them or candidates. They'll say, oh gosh, I just got laid off and I need to reach out to my network. And I haven't talked to some of these people for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Right. We've all done it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge problem. Because I think part of being intentional in your career is staying connected.
Right.
Staying connected to your peers, stay connected to your mentors, your former colleagues, your former bosses, because those are the people that are going to help you in times of trouble. Don't only reach out when it's a time of trouble. Reach out. Stay connected when things are great.
Right.
So that when things aren't great, they'll show up.
Yeah. And that's a lesson for life, not just work. And I think that probably people do exactly the same thing in life. You know, it's like they'll have someone and then they end up in this position where it's almost like, dang it, now I've got to ask them for something. And then there's no relationship to build on. I think that, you know, one of the challenges with this too, from a few people I've spoken with, is, you know, as people are looking at their work, a number of colleagues that I know across different companies and across different industries are in leadership roles. And what I found telling is in those conversations, they want to do what they do, but they kind of are over being managers of people. They're thinking, I don't want to deal with it. I just want to do my job and be responsible for myself. And that's an outgrowth of the experience of being quarantined, working from home, all of this type of thing. And I'm trying to figure out, as I've spoken to a few of them, what's really at the core of it here. Because I actually did a post the other day where I was saying that it's challenging. It's a lot of work managing people. And at the risk of some conceit, I've been told that I'm a good manager. But that's because I actually am very interested in the people and what's good for them and making sure that I keep them engaged. And when the difficulties come, I find a way of making sure I get through them quickly. But I think a lot of people just now have come to see it as an additional set of responsibilities that they'd rather not take on. And as they're looking at this whole concept of work going forward, how do people who are in leadership roles and management roles find their best path to remaining engaged where they can continue to enjoy what they do, but if they're in a management role, also considering that that's part of it? That's where I'm trying to get to.
Well, I mean, let's face it, leading people and managing people is hard.
Yeah.
Like you said, it is hard. And not everyone likes to do it. And unfortunately, as we grow in our careers, moving up the ladder, so to speak, is managing more and more people as you go, right? That's not every career field has a path for senior level practitioners. You have to become a leader, a manager. Let's take sales as a great example. You could be the best salesperson on the planet.
Right.
And what happens? They promote you to be a sales manager. And then you suck at it because you don't want to be responsible for other people.
Right.
You don't want to have to hold anybody else accountable because what made you a great salesperson was your own accountability. And so sales is a good field for that because you can continue to grow and be a better salesperson and better salesperson. You're going to make more money, but not taking that people management role is often hard because you want to move up. And then what do? When you're not a great people manager.
Right.
So I think that it's going to depend on the career field you're in. And, you know, that's, I think, why a lot of people opt out and say, I think I'm going to become a consultant because I can be a senior level practitioner and I won't have to manage other people in the process.
That's a huge leap for a lot of people to make. I understand. I've got some really good friends. I've got friends who are awesome, to your point, at what they do. And they want career growth, but they absolutely do not want to manage anyone. And I usually get into a little bit of a verbal war with them because I was like, you got to do it. It's the only way that you're going to be able to get what you want. But at the same time, and companies I've worked for, I've always struggled with how can I take a person who wants to be more the individual contributor and also bring them along on a career path where they can still contribute tremendously to the company. But at the same time, it's not going to require them to take on doing so with other people. I will tell you, I've yet to find an answer to that question, but I'm still looking for it. And I think a lot of companies are, which is going to be an ongoing challenge, particularly now as people are looking for meaning in their work. And I think a sense of, I value what I contribute, and that should be enough. As we look at this, I think that's going to be one of the emerging challenges going forward, is to make sure that people are able to look at people as they are and what they can contribute and find a place for them that works nonetheless. Yes?
Well, can't that be a consultant model? In a way, I mean, I know companies who, I mean, I've done searches where I've recruited, since I'm a communications recruiter, right? So where I've recruited someone very senior level, they may have held the director title, but they were a team of one. And it always makes me smile when I talk to people and say, well, I'm looking for a very senior level practitioner. There are no direct reports. And I get these sighs of relief. Like, yes, hallelujah. I really want that job. Right. There are people who love and thrive in managing people. And thank goodness for them, because great people managers are hard to find. Mm-hmm. And when they're really good at it, companies need those people. Mm-hmm. They need people who know how to lead, know how to hold people accountable, know how to hire, know when to fire. Those are all really important skill sets, mm-hmm. but everybody doesn't have to have those skill sets.
That's right.
And so I think companies, so like when you think about your team, Charles, you know, you have a great individual contributor. Well, find the role that requires that big thinker, that really great senior practitioner. I think about executive communications is also that is often a job that does that, because you need somebody who has the gravitas to work with the C-suite every single day, mm-hmm. and be their writer and their consultant, if you will, to the C-suite on how they're communicating. That executive communications person may not need anyone working for them, mm-hmm. but you need someone who's not 5 years out of school.
Right, right, right. Let me digress a little bit, since we did talk about communications, a love of both of ours, obviously, given what we do. You know, I've been hearing a lot of chatter now that talks about the value of communications / marketing now, you know, post COVID-19. And what that's going to look like. A few of the professional organizations I have joined are specifically looking at ways that we could leverage what's been learned and apply it anew for what's going to be happening in this industry going forward. Are you seeing, Angie, any trends in terms of what people are asking for in terms of the roles that they're trying to fill that differ from the pre-COVID experience?
Well, one thing that if COVID taught us nothing, I think that organizations who may not have held communications on the pedestal that it should be held on, mm-hmm. in my humble opinion, they finally are like, oh yeah, especially employee communications. Oh, this is important stuff, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to make sure that you're really in tune with what is happening with the employees, mm-hmm. and what they, how they're getting information and what information they're getting. And, you know, can they need to understand the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. If your employees know the bigger picture and how their job fits into that bigger picture, they're going to be more interested and engaged and want to be there. Mm-hmm. So I think the good news is that companies are like, this is a really critical role for our company, mm-hmm. or a critical function for our company. Mm-hmm. And so they want to make sure they have really strong people. And I believe that strong communications leaders are business people first. You got to know the business, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't care if it's, because I'm sure your audience are more than just communications professionals. Right. I think anyone who wants to move up in an organization, the better you understand the business, mm-hmm. the better you're going to be at your particular function.
And isn't that true that, you know, I spoke with Damon Jones from Procter & Gamble a few episodes back. Loved the conversation. And it certainly echoes exactly what you're saying is certainly, I think that for a lot of organizations, it can be difficult for them to pinpoint exactly what they need in a leader. So they go out with this description of, I need A, B, C, and D. As a recruiter and a, you know, career counselor, when you come across those things, when you're working with clients, and I don't want you to go, you know, too deep into detail because they're your private clients, but yeah. How often are you able to help them reassess what they expect a communicator is supposed to be doing?
Well, I actually have a process for just that. And I am happy to share it, because if everyone adopted this process, mm-hmm. they would hire smarter, okay. no matter what.
Okay.
And that is, yes, you have a job description that says, I need somebody with a bachelor's degree in marketing or an MBA or whatever, right? Like they can say whatever they want. I need somebody with this list of 10 skills. Great, fine. Now, what I really want you to do, and this is what I make my clients do, I start with the business goals. What are the business goals of the organization as a whole? And what are the goals of the function that you're hiring the person for? Then I take a step back and I say, all right, now what is this person going to actually do? to help you achieve those goals. So we're putting a direct line of sight between the responsibilities of this individual, what they're going to accomplish, and the goals of the organization and the function. Mm-hmm. And then I take another step back and I say, okay, what competencies or characteristics are really important for a person to do that well here? Mm-hmm. And that gets to the culture piece, right? And I actually have people define it. Somebody says, oh, we need somebody really creative. Well, if I asked your chief technology officer and your legal head of legal and your CMO what creative means, they are all going to give you a different answer. So let's define what those characteristics are so that we're all voting for the same thing during the evaluation process. Right. And then I say, okay, let's take one more step back. What team tools and resources are in place in order to help this person be successful in the role? Once we get that figured out, I actually really press hard with my clients to say, now let's talk about what success looks like. 3 months from now, what happened? 6 months from now, what did this person achieve? If you're sitting with your employee 1 year from their start date, what do you hope happened? What did they get done? Mm. And I want like real tangible things. Like it could be, oh, we're completely rebranding our whole corporate identity. This person's going to have that project on their plate. Okay, that's cool to talk about. And it's a great way for me as a recruiter to find people who've done that before. But if all I'm looking for is somebody who has on a line on a job description that says, you know, able to work in websites, it's not the same thing, right? Like what strategic level do I need? What tactical level do I need? That's where you get into the, what is this person going to actually do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, Angie, the reason outside of obviously knowing you as I do, I thought you would be so great for this is because while you of course won't do it, I'll do it. Your model applies to any job. You're not saying it, I'm saying it. Because this assessment of knowing what you want the person to actually achieve, knowing exactly what's important to you, is not one that I find applied that routinely. It is just a job description. You know, the interesting thing about being in this business for a while too, is not a week that goes by that I'm not, you know, approached by someone who gives themselves the label recruiter. Let's just say I don't believe all of them, okay, who approaches me with something and you look at it and you're like, what is this? You know, when you've been around long enough, you're like, this is clearly not someone or some company that knows what they want. And that kind of bugs me because it makes it difficult for people who are practitioners, who are out in the market, to actually identify where they can fit. And then particularly if it's something that they've applied for, that they're very clear that they are a fit for, and that's something that they can discern for themselves. And then the person or the company comes back and says, well, I'm sorry, you're not a fit. And it's like, what the, right? Where is the line between self-awareness and self-destruction, I'm going to call it that, when it comes to that kind of work, that level of discernment, not only on the part of the company, because you want to bring in great people, but in regard to individuals who are out here looking, who think that the world has been turned upside down, because even though they know they have skills and abilities and opportunities to contribute, they're being told no. How does that work?
Well, I think that there's two sides of that coin. When you look at your resume, you know that your resume is not telling the whole story of Charles, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. it tells about a third of your professional
right,
story.
Right.
I mean, your resume is kind of given, okay, here's a quick rundown of where I've been, what my degree is, mm-hmm. few accomplishment bullet points, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But who you are, the essence of you, is not really able to be on a resume.
That's right. That's right.
A job description is kind of the same, right? I always say a job description tells about a third of the story, right? Here's some basic qualifications I'm going to need and I'm going to look. But when I'm working on a search, when I'm recruiting for something, there's a whole story that I know that's not on paper. Mm-hmm. So if I don't always post jobs, but if I did post a job and somebody applied for it, I actually had this happen the other day. Mm-hmm. I posted a job, someone applied for it, and I sent a very nice thanks, but I don't think you're a fit for this role. And mm-hmm. I'd love to stay in touch with you for other roles in the future. And he sent me a note back and said, I disagree with you. I'm like, and in my head, I was like, Well, that's okay. You totally can disagree with me, but I know stuff you don't know.
Right, right.
Right. And so, you know, sometimes I'll say, well, all right, let's have a conversation. Let's see if I'm wrong. And I wasn't. I did have a conversation. And I wasn't wrong. But there are things that are not on the job description. So I totally understand the frustration of candidates who get the rejection letter and they're like, wait a minute, I looked at the job description and I've done all those things. But does your resume show that you've done all those things? Or do you just know that you did all those things? Is your resume reflecting the experience that's most important for this job? And this, you know, and you can drive yourself crazy rewriting your resume for every job. And that's why your network's so important. Job postings are a lot. Job postings are important, but it's not how a lot of jobs are obtained. They're obtained because somebody who knows you says, oh, you need a guy that can do that. This guy can do that. Right? It's about what are you going to do to help them achieve the goals?
See, that's I think that's a really important distinction, because it's easy to, you know, lay blame, right? You know, I'm qualified and I'm all of this. Personally, I hate resumes. I have mine done by people because I write for a living. I'm the worst resume writer for myself ever. Bring me someone else's. Right. I can do a good job of helping them. But in my own mind, I mean, Angie, I've been doing this for over 30 years. I'm like, how do I encapsulate all of this? So that's the reason I rely on people with expertise. But I think that there is this tendency now, because this is what people are hearing. Oh, everybody has jobs. There are so many jobs and all you have to do is apply. And they think that the door is going to open magically. They're just going to walk in and there's a new job for them on the horizon. But that's not really the truth. And they need to own up to acknowledging that, right? Because there aren't like millions of jobs just waiting for people to walk into them. It still requires a process. Yes?
For sure. I mean, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice if you'd say, oh, look at this job posting. It's perfect. You apply, the recruiter calls you the next day. Call goes great. Three interviews later, you have an offer in your hand. Oh, if only.
Yeah. And that point you made about the fact that you know stuff that applicants wouldn't. Conversely, there are things applicants know. For instance, when I talked about the recruiters, when they send me things, I'm like, have you even looked up any information on me? Why are you approaching me with this? And I'm not in a position where I'm actively looking for anything, but it's always useful, because I will use that networking approach, because I tell people all the time, well, you know, it's not for me, but I may know some people. Let me see what I can find out. But when they come and approach a potential applicant, I still think that there has to be some sense of responsibility to say, I am sending this to you because you seem to be a fit. 99% of stuff that people send me, I'm thinking, so you just sent me a manager of communications role, and I'm a chief communications officer currently. How did you get there? So how do you address that type of dichotomy?
Well, I mean, I think that there are different skill levels of recruiters, right?
And you're such a diplomat.
Well, but I mean, it's true. Like, imagine if you're an internal corporate recruiter and you're literally working on 20 requisitions at a time. And you're not an expert in a certain field. Like, I'm an expert in communications, right? So I can speak shorthand with my hiring leaders and I can speak shorthand with my candidates, because when you tell me, you know, you're a media relations person, I don't have to ask what you mean by that, right? I know this stuff. So I think that when you have a less experienced recruiter, they may just be looking for some keywords. They're throwing spaghetti on the wall to see what sticks. Not ideal. I will say, as a shameless self-promotion, that's why you hire a recruiter with expertise.
That's right.
So that it shortens the time, right? And it shortens the time of the search and the quality of candidates that are put in front of you. If that recruiter has a good reputation, good experience, good skill set, they're going to be able to get you what you need specifically, right? Saves a lot of people a lot of time. So I think it's frustrating as well. I get those things on LinkedIn, you know, where people are trying to sell you stuff. I get a lot, because since I'm both a recruiter and a career coach, the word coach is in my profile. I get tons of people that are trying to sell coaching to coaches, or let me do marketing for coaches. And they all send me LinkedIn things about saying, oh, I see we have people in common, we should connect. And I connected with a couple at the beginning, and then suddenly I'm getting bombarded with sales pitches. And I'm like, okay, enough.
Exactly. But in terms of the shameless plug, it's not shameless when it's true. And, you know, at the risk, again, of just calling a thing, the reason that you're sitting here and not some other people is because you've proven to me over the years what you do. Other people, not so much. And I will say, because I'm not nearly as diplomatic as you are, the younger, newer recruiters, I get it. But let me tell you, I have dealt with some of them from the big ones, you know, the big organizations. Mm-hmm, and I'm just like, really, boo? Is this how we're going to play this game? So I appreciate the candor that you're bringing to this, because you're not letting people off the hook where just because they want a job that they have this expectation that they're supposed to be able to get a job. It requires work, coordination, engagement beyond just, you know, running to the hills the moment that you figure that there's something that you need. You have to do it while you're working as much as when you're not working to make sure that you can actually, I love that, you know, word again, intentionally prepare yourself for not only where you are now, but hopefully where you intend to be, right?
Well, yeah. And one of the things I do, and it's always interesting to me how people react to this, is when I'm working on a certain search, I don't just send, like if I was working on a search and I wanted you to be a candidate for I would not send you the job spec and say, hey, are you interested in this? Let's have a conversation. Right. I just wouldn't do it.
I know.
The way that I reach out is I say, hey, I'm working on some stuff and you look like somebody I need to have in my, on my radar, might be good, might not be good. Let's get on the phone and have a conversation. And I always talk about, I want to learn more about your background and career goals because it's not good enough for me to have a great job. What if that great job isn't going in the direction you're trying to go next? So I want to get to know you as a person and what you're about, where you've been and where you're headed. Because for me, career, being deliberate in your career means you're not running away from something, you're running toward the next thing that's the right next thing. And so I want to know what you want to run toward. So maybe this is it. Maybe it's the next job I have. I don't know.
Right. And it aligns with the statement you made about job descriptions and details that you know that a potential applicant wouldn't know, because in having that conversation, you are listening with an ear of understanding that says, okay, this is what I know I'm looking for specifically. And if you hear it, if you sense it, then you can tell from that conversation versus just giving someone a cold job description who is probably saying, God, I hate the job I'm in currently. Oh, this looks like it's good. I'm gonna apply. Well, it's a lot more than that. And that's where people, I think, sometimes fall down on the job of intention, is because they are applying for a job to escape a situation or for other reasons beyond the fact that the job is one that they can do. And I've certainly sensed that, because, you know, it's difficult hiring people. I mean, I had some small things for the job that I'm in that I did last year, and you know, going through our HR process and you're seeing all these applications, and I'm thinking, I am intentional because I wrote the job description. It wasn't one just written by HR. And when you see it, you're like, did they read a word of what I said? So I want to reinforce as part of this, as we're talking about how people work now, that we use your phrase of intentionality and apply it. And that we also ask people to give consideration to those things you've described in terms of what their goals and aspirations are. And then finally, to understand what a potential employer is looking for as well, not just in terms of what they feel they fit into, but in terms of where it can take them down the line. Did I get
it
right? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Because I do think that, you know, one of the things that I've seen too in terms of trends going forward is people really want to hire folks who are in it for being part of something greater than themselves. That whole search for meaning that we talked about earlier. I find that the older I get, the more I long to know that aside from the P&L, aside from the things that are perceptible in terms of how well the company's doing, there's nothing more fulfilling than when you do something and you know it has meaning to you personally. And if it can have meaning in some tangible way outside of the organization, I'm in the healthcare business, so being able to help people feel better and recover is important. That's what gets me up in the morning. Can you speak a little bit about that kind of intentionality about what it takes to get people where they are engaged for the long term that you've seen, if anything, because I know that it may not be possible, that you've seen that may shift in the coming years because of all of this change that we've undergone. People want meaning. Have you seen anything so far that indicates that is directionally where all of us are going to be headed?
So what I think is funny is you said, as I get older, finding purpose and meaning in my work is more and more important. Mm-hmm. What is absolutely, to me, amusing about that mm-hmm. is you read all these articles forever and ever and ever. There's all these articles about millennials want purpose-filled work. Gen Z will only work for companies mm-hmm. with purpose, mission-driven companies. Mm-hmm. I have never spoken to a candidate who did not tell me, I don't care what age or stage mm-hmm. they are in their career. Mm-hmm. I have never had a candidate say to me that they want to work for a company that has absolutely no purpose for good.
There you go.
Ever. Like right. Every single candidate mm-hmm. always says, well, I want a job that, you know, is values driven. I want a company that has purpose. I want mission driven work. And a lot of times people go to the, oh, well, I have to work at a nonprofit if I want mission driven or purpose driven work. And that's totally not true. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of organizations are doing good mm-hmm. and doing well. They don't have to be nonprofits.
Right.
They can be lots. When I lived in Seattle, I often used the example, you know, DocuSign is in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I had all these graduate students are like, oh, I only want to work for companies that are doing good for the environment. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with a company like DocuSign? They have completely changed the world for electronic signature. Do you know how many stacks of paper were put in a FedEx envelope and shipped across the country before companies like DocuSign? Mm-hmm. I mean, think of all the trees we've saved and all the fossil fuels we've saved. Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that good?
Mm-hmm. That's I never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
That's
so I think that I think people need to think bigger and broader when they think about purpose-driven, feeling good, all of that. There's lots of things that can make you feel good mm-hmm. about the work you're doing and the place you're doing it. And I don't think it matters how old you are. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it ever has, pre-pandemic mm-hmm. or post-pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think people want to feel good about what they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I'm still sitting here a little blown away by the. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I've used DocuSign for years, and I've yet never thought about it in the context you just described it. That's mind blowing to me, and I do think that that's a huge, you know, chasm for a lot of people. We have a general idea of a place. It's a company, right? And that's all we know about it. But we don't dig down into the DNA of it to find out what it's really about. And why what it's doing is more important than we perhaps give it credit for. I feel kind of stupid right now.
Well, that wasn't my intention.
Well, no, it's okay because how do you use something in that thing? Oh my gosh, because I'm doing it this way, this is the outcome of it. And I've never done that, but I will going forward, I promise you. Andy, here's another thing I think is interesting. You brought up the subject of generations. It's an interesting subject. I am equally fascinated and dumbfounded by younger people these days. That is not a function of being older. That's a function of the fact that I was never my chronological age. I always was a lot more emotionally mature, I would like to call it. And it wasn't me saying, it's what other people told me. So I didn't necessarily connect with my actual chronological generation. But as I watch, you know, the younger generations now, so much of what they do just resonates with me on a very personal level, and I love them for it. But other things, I have no words. Because these are going to be the individuals who are going to be fueling businesses and organizations and leadership roles going forward, what does, whether it's communications, and speak broadly on that as you choose, but as it applies to just the larger world of work, what are we going to be looking at in terms of what this whole experience of COVID-19 and surviving it is going to mean to them and how it's going to influence perhaps how they approach work? Any thoughts on that?
Well, what I'm reading and sort of seeing, I think it kind of depends on the stage of the person's life. I mean, if the reality is if you have a young family, and a new mortgage, and your decision-making process is very different than if you're, you know, 25 years old and still living in your parents' house, or, you know, you have three roommates, so that, you know, you don't have a lot of things encumbering you, right? Then you can make different decisions. But I do know that there's all kinds of articles out there about how young workers, you know, in their 20s, I'm assuming, are opting to take a year off and travel. Like, they're saying, hey, you know what? I'm just not, life is too short, and I'm not going to work my butt off at a company that I'm not really excited about. And so I'm just going to go do this other thing. Traveling isn't quite on the radar yet, but people are doing other things. They're finding passion projects, or, you know, being ski instructors or something. You know, they're picking things that are more interesting to them, but not necessarily career moves. I honestly don't think that's a bad thing. I did that in my 20s, and there was no pandemic. My PR career was chugging along, doing great. And I literally jumped off the ladder and went onto a cruise ship and sailed around the world for 3 years as a writer editor.
Wow.
And that was like, did it change my career trajectory? 100%. It changed my career trajectory. Do I have any regrets? Not one. I've been to more than 100 countries, and I have friends for life because of the experience. And I have no regret.
That's very inspirational, by the way. It sounds wonderful. I can't do the cruise ship because of germophobia, but the rest of it, it sounds really, really good. And when you're looking at life, because Michael's here in this room and he's a younger person, I hate using that phrase because I don't want to just lump everybody in the same group, but he's a lot younger than me. So is this resonating with you? He's agreeing. So see, there you go. You've already got yourself a person who agrees with you. And the thing that I think is important is to be inspired by this. That part that I said about being around younger people that inspires me is that flexibility, the ability to just throw it all to the wind and say, you know what, I'll think about that another day, but today I'm just going to live my life. And I will say, regardless of age, to your point, I've been just absolutely gobsmacked, I'll use that word, by just how much freedom has come from what we have learned over these past 16 or 17, however many it's been now, months, about that individual drive to live life. Work is a part of life, but it is not the main driver of it. It never should be, in my opinion. And when we're looking at, I keep going back to the word intentionality. I love that word, and I love that you've written about it, because I think that if we all looked at the world that we share with eyes on intention versus perception, we could solve all the world's problems just like that. So let me just get that out of the way. But when it comes to the intentionality of work, I think that I want to get your perspective on what do you anticipate is going to happen that will help us get back on track in the next year, that will get us to a point where we are truly post-COVID-19 and have a really good set of insights as to how the world of work is going to look going forward.
If I knew the answer to that, I would be a gajillionaire. I could retire tomorrow for sure. I don't think we know. Who knows? Nobody knows, right? I mean, we don't even know. I mean, thank goodness we have vaccinations and people can start resuming a fairly interactive life. I'm not going to say normal because I don't know what normal is anymore, but we can resume a fairly interactive life. And who knows what that's going to mean in the future? What, you know, what if one of these strains kicks, you know, raises its ugly head? But what I do know is, What I learned during this pandemic is tomorrow is not promised. And people that we did not expect to no longer be with us are no longer with us. And that the way that we've operated our day-to-day lives has changed, and probably permanently. And so you said it earlier, adaptability is important, but I'm a big believer that if there's something that's important to you, pay attention to that. And work on that and do that. Because what if tomorrow is not available?
Yeah. You know, there's an old saying that says, whatever feeds your soul, do that. And that's what you're saying. And I think that that's interesting, you know, for a number of reasons. I think that we do tend to, in the conversations about work and career, we tend to lose that sense of faithfulness, whatever your subscription to faith is, spirituality, that says that we are doing this in a way that will be aligned with who we are as individuals. Work shouldn't just be some separate thing that you put on and take off at the end of the day. I think you live into your work if you are going to actually have a career. And interestingly, even though you said you don't have the answer, I think you actually did just give the answer, which is to live your life and figure out how to make work fit into it, whatever that life is, whatever you aspire for it to be. That's what I'm taking away from what you said, because it's no longer, oh my God, I've just got to have a job. That's not the dynamic anymore. It's, I really want to do the work that I do. I really want to enjoy the work that I do. And I really want it to be a part of the life I live overall. That's my paraphrasing of it.
I think that it's, we have incredible privilege when we can live and love our work.
Right.
I think that's a place of privilege. Mm-hmm. Because there are people who just need a job.
Right, right.
Right. And no shame in that, man. Mm-hmm. You got to pay the bills. You got to feed your family. Mm-hmm. No shame. Mm-hmm. But when you have the opportunity to have a job that is a fit for you and that you don't, that you enjoy getting up and going to, that's great. Mm-hmm. And that's where, again, my belief is, if that's important to you, then strive for that. Mm-hmm. But you have to work on it. You mm-hmm. have to be intentional about it. You right. can't, it's not going to just like, poof. I remember, this is a weird analogy, but I'm going to throw it out there. Dr. Phil, 100 years ago, doing whatever he does on TV. And he mm-hmm. was saying to this single woman, do you think you're going to meet the man of your dreams because he jumps on the roof of your car while you're going to the grocery store? Mm-hmm. You have to put effort into this, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of laughed about that. As a single person. And so I think about that in our work too. The perfect job or your career aspirations aren't going to just throw, you know, just show up mm-hmm. because you thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice if this happened? No, you have to work toward it. Mm-hmm. You have to put some intention behind it. You have to have self-awareness. Right. You have to have good conversations so others can help you get there.
Mm-hmm. You know, it is. I love this conversation. I knew it was going to be good. So, you know, I've been at every level of need when it comes to work, you know, and I remember when I had jobs that I absolutely abhorred, but they were putting food on the table, paying for the tuition, whatever the need was at the time, and you dealt with them as mm-hmm. I moved on and did better and went through my career. However, I mean, I've left great jobs. I remember in one of my books, I wrote a piece where I was talking about how when I left one job in particular, when you are a Black person and you've got what's called a good job, you do not leave that job. And everybody thinks you're crazy because I'm talking in terms of, you know, it's not fulfilling me. I don't enjoy even thinking about doing it anymore. And they're like, but you get paid a good amount. I was like, it's not about the money. And I actually titled that piece, Giving Up a Paycheck and Getting a Life. And that's the growth level. So I hear you when it comes to that, because I know what it's like. Certain times you've got to stick through it. I worked in a nursing home once, Angie. It was the most horrific thing in the world for a germaphobe.
Yes, I can imagine.
But it paid the bill, so I did what I did. But I have grown into understanding what privilege that is. And though I may still on occasion, because I've left a lot of jobs, I've never been fired, but I have left a lot of jobs because I independently understand the intention you're talking about. And if it's not serving you and you have the means and the methods to ensure that you can go on until you find whatever is next for you, I highly endorse it because there's nothing worse than a person who's miserable in their work, not only for them, but because of what it does to the culture of the organization of which they're a part. People who hang around and poison the well, poison it not just for themselves, but for other people. And I think that's what we have to help people realize you need, if you're going to go there and do that, then it's time to go. At least that's my perspective on it. And yeah, what are your thoughts?
If you have the ability to leave a job without a job, you know, not everybody can do that.
Absolutely.
But if you can, sometimes you just have to. One of the people I interviewed for my podcast, he was working for a large corporation in a great job, making great money. And he was just getting physically sick from the stress and the unhappiness, but his health was at risk because of where he was. And he took a year sabbatical and what a gift, right? Like he did all the things that he wanted to do during that year. He went to the, Culinary Academy and did month-long culinary thing. And he went to Argentina and he did all these things. Mm-hmm. And what he learned, he really thought he would never be in technology again because it just was, he was like, oh, I'm just done with all this, right? Mm-hmm. And what he learned in his year was he loved technology. Mm-hmm. And he came back and he got a job at a different really large technology company and was super happy. And he needed the break and he needed to do that. So one of the things that I do when I'm coaching someone is I give them an exercise that's my values vision exercise available on my website. So the values vision exercise, I think it's such a great thing to think about. Like, what are your strengths? Jump on Gallup Strengths Finder, do your strengths. What are your values? What are your priorities? What are your preferences? What motivates you, and put all that together and create your career vision and just make it happen. Like, check in with that. And like I said earlier, you work with an organization that aligns with your values and you won't make that a bad choice.
The world of work as we see it going forward, then, I think is one that really isn't a new normal. It's a practice that's always been available to us. I just don't think necessarily people reason and tap into it. Again, for the 500th time, I'm going to say intentionality is so very important because I think you have got to really figure out who you are to work successfully. Whatever's important to you, whatever you value, that's going to go into what you bring to the table at work as well. And I do think that what's so compelling about what you do, Angie, is that you're such a straight shooter with people in terms of telling them, you know, not necessarily what they want to hear. You're not one of those people who's going to give participation trophies to everybody. And I admire that about you. You're not going to be like, no, just as we talk, that's not the way it is. But you also do it out of a sense of, I think, respect for every person figuring out for themselves what's best for them. And because you do it that way, I think that's what makes you a great counselor. I think it's what makes you a great recruiter, but I also think that it flows directly from the nature of who you are as a human being. If you didn't bring to the table the perspectives and the perceptions you have as a human being, what you do on a daily basis wouldn't be possible because you'd be like so many others out there who are just going through the motions of recruiting and coaching people. How do you want to ensure that this becomes an approach that people can embrace for themselves by making sure that they are discerning carefully when they're seeking help, people like you that they're going to work with? This is where you're not going to call it a shameless plug. This is me doing it. But how do people who want to do the things we've discussed here today and want help in doing so reach someone like you, including you if you're a communications pro, to access those services?
Yeah, so I primarily work with marketing and communications professionals on the recruiting side for sure. On the coaching side, I have done coaching for people outside of those functions, but people that are in those functions particularly like working with me because I get what they do. Mm-hmm. We all think we're special and unique and different, and because I get what marketing and communications people do, it's nice to have someone to help guide their career who actually understands what that career path is or could be. Mm-hmm. So individuals like that, you can reach me on my website, of course, lindsaycareers.com. Lindsay is spelled without a D, which is always confusing to people. and I'm always happy to have a conversation with somebody who just wants to figure out if I'm the right person. Because I'm not the right person for everybody.
Right.
And I have an introductory call with people, and I have said on more than one occasion, you know what? I don't think I'm the right coach for you. Mm. And I may send you to another person I know, or at least to a resource that you might find someone else. Mm-hmm. I've done the same with my recruiting. You know, if you want help finding a really strong communications leader or marketing leader, or even mid-level person, I'm a great person to go to for that, because that's my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. I have a wide network in there. I understand the work, and I know how to find those people. So I would always welcome anyone who would want to learn about that. If you're just looking for a career coach, there's many out there. LinkedIn's a great resource to find people that have all different kinds of specialties. I mean, there's career coaches that just do resumes, and there's career coaches that are soup to nuts. So I think it's a personality-driven thing. Mm-hmm. You want to find somebody who you trust and believe can help you get to where you're trying to go.
Yeah. And I think that the greatest testament to that is the fact that, you know, Angie and I initially met because you reached out to me about something, and it wasn't right, and it didn't work out. Yet here we are all those years later. Why? Because of what you brought to the table. And the fact that you showed me that you were completely authentic in your approach. And these are the kind of people, when you're speaking about that network, you want to have in the network. I feel very comfortable if I want to bounce something off you, asking you a question or whatever the case may be. And I think that's the nature of a really good relationship, is to make sure that you remain engaged with people in real ways and real times. Plus, we're both pretty freaking direct, so... It doesn't hurt that we don't pull punches with one another. But I do want to make sure that people understand that you are a tremendous resource. And if you haven't been applying any of the things that you've heard Angie speak about today in terms of your job search, or if you're an organization that is looking for people but not taking into account the things that you've heard her speak to in terms of what you need to provide for the culture, then you're missing out. The world of work going forward really is an individualized thing. It's not a collective thing. And what Angie has taught us today is give yourself the time to practice intention, whether you are a person looking for work or you're someone looking to hire someone for work. Because without that being at the forefront of your actions, nothing else is really going to work out all that well. That's me saying it. That's not Angie saying it. So I want to thank you so much for spending this hour with me. It is exactly the kind of conversation I felt we would have. And I want to also say that it is always great to deal with people who are exactly as they are 100% of the time. And you certainly fall into that category. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles. It's been really fun talking to you.